This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. This is your HedgeGhoul master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. And today we'll be discussing North Wicklow in the revolutionary decade. While not in the vanguard of armed activity in the revolutionary decade, North Wicklow was, nevertheless, active in other respects. Moreover, its unique characteristics, proximity to Dublin, pioneering development of tourism, and one of the highest Protestant populations outside of Ulster, make it worthy of study. So we're joined here by a panel of local historians, and this is part of the Wicklow Heritage Project. They have their own website. We have from Greystones, Rosemary Rauter. From Bray, James Scannell, from Enniskerry, Brian White, and we're also joined by John Dorney to bring a national perspective to our discussion. And John, of course, is the editor of The Irish Story and also the author of Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1924. And just, I might add that James Scannell, of course, has been the compiler of History Ireland's events page for the last number of years. Now, this podcast is supported by the Commemoration Unit of the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media, and by Wicklow County Council's Archives Service. Now, Brian White, can I go to you first just to give us some idea of the neighbourhood we're talking about? So we're talking about North Wicklow, in particular the towns of Bray, Greystones and Enniskerry. And this, of course, was part of the East Wicklow-Westminster constituency. Brian, how would you sum up the economy and the society of this region?
The whole area was basically around tourism and the promotion of tourism from England and from Dublin, because we have to remember the railway company played a vital role in bringing the Dubliners out. The population of the area in 1919 was about 8,000 in the Bray area alone, and that then rose in the summer months to double its capacity, so about 16,000 people.
Just give me that again. So the population you're saying doubled then because of the seasonal, the tourism thing.
The seasonal tourism.
I think it's useful, interesting to point out that Wicklow is the first tourism area in Ireland. I mean, it's in there even, you know, before Killarney and other well-known places. I mean, it's not called the Garden of Ireland for nothing.
In relation to the how Bray became the Irish Brighton, and again, this is down to the package holidays run by Thomas Cook and others to Bray and now, to the North Wicklow area, where they went to the likes of Wooden Bridge, Enniskerry, Glendalough and Greystones. And Bray got the title of the Irish Brighton. Wooden Bridge was the Irish Balmoral. And Enniskerry was known as the Alpine Village.
Some great purple prose there in that promotion, right? So, listen, Rosemary, can I bring you in here? Because the other characteristic of this, the entire county, is the relatively high Protestant population. As I understand it, possibly the highest outside of Ulster. Or maybe
I think
similar
so.
To Dublin.
Yeah, I think so. First of all, as Brian says, tourism was important, but Greystones was probably rather different to Bray. It would have been had a sort of more genteel image, and you'd have had a pattern of families, largely middle class, largely Protestant families, coming out and spending a few months in the summer here. People like the Becketts who spent summers here. So you do have that. Yes, Wicklow as a whole was about 22% Protestant in 1911, which of course would have been relatively high. But within that then, the Greystones and Delgany area would have been just over 50% Protestant, and Greystones itself was about 56% Protestant. So very pronounced Protestant. And actually, I did come across a reference in the Northern paper to another orange area south of the Boyne, referring to Greystones and to the
now,
orange. Protestant Connection.
The only thing is, though, just when I say, when we say Protestant, that does not necessarily mean Unionist John Dorney, does it?
No, because absolutely not. No, no.
I want to bring John in this, John Dorney. There is quite a substantial, what I might call, patriotic Protestant or nationalist Protestant tradition in Wicklow, is there not?
Absolutely. And I mean, you can take this right back to 1798, where the Protestant population was very much politically split between a pro-United Irish cohort and the Unionist or a Loyalist at the time, was the phrase. And this continues throughout the 19th century. And famously, of course, Parnell, the leader of late 19th century nationalism, was a Wicklow Protestant. And I think you can see this through this period as well. Like Bob Barton is elected, not for the constituency we're talking about, but for West Wicklow, as a Sinn Féin MP in 1918, or TD, as he would have seen it. So it's not a sectarian thing in the sense of we might think of, say, Belfast at its most extreme, certainly not. On the other hand, there is also a strong kind of Irish tradition in County Wicklow. And that's a factor too. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the economy as tourism related, and that's true, but it's also a county of hill farmers and quarrymen. And there is, to an extent, a sectarian division there as well. I think Rosemary wanted to come back on that.
Yeah, Rosemary, can I, because you were in discussions before this, you were saying that quite a number of people signed the Ulster Covenant in this neighbourhood. Is that true?
Yes, the connection actually was with the Ulster Declaration, which of course was the women's version of the Covenant. And looking at that, 21 women with Wicklow addresses signed the Covenant. But if you go further than that, if you look through the Declaration as a whole, you will see that 46 at least women with Wicklow addresses actually signed somewhere or other. Now, most of those would have had Ulster connections, but they would also have had strong Wicklow connections, and there were a few that were actually born and reared in Wicklow and may only have had the most passing connection with Ulster.
Now, John, can I move on here to the formation of the Ulster Volunteers, right? How active was this area in that? And of course, it's the only place where guns were landed separately from Holt. We were all familiar with the Holt gun running. But of course, arms were landed at Kilcool. So what's going on in this area at that stage?
Well, in terms of the first part of your question, Tommy, Dublin and Wicklow are I think, one Orange Lodge, for example. They're not differentiated, but there's about 2,000 members of that Orange Lodge at the time. So it's substantial. And there's a Dublin branch, you could say, of the Ulster Volunteers, except before, this is at the time of the Home Rule crisis, it's called the Loyal Dublin Volunteers, who did have an arms cache. This is some of the arms at Larne ended up in Dublin, and they were later found in Parnell Square. I believe there was some Wicklow members of this, I don't have the details. In terms of the second part of your question, the Kilcool landing was a subsidiary, as you rightly say, to the Howth gun running. It's quite different, though, from the Howth gun running in the sense that it's secret. So the Howth gun running, the whole point is that they do it in public and they make a big show that they're able to do this. And a lot of the separatists involved were very happy that there was a confrontation with the British military. Kilcool thing is totally different. It's done at the dead of night and the idea is to get in the arms without being intercepted. There was a Wicklow man, of course, involved, a famous Wicklow man, Erskine Childers, whose home was near Glendalough, I gather. But I wouldn't say it was really a Wicklow operation. I think it was mostly a Dublin operation, and you know, the Kilcool was chosen precisely because it was kind of anonymous.
Okay, James, have you anything to say on this? Yeah, James, bring you in there. What happened to Kilcool weapons? Like, do we know were any of them fired in anger?
They were probably used in 1916. One of the funny things about Kilcool is that it should have taken place on the eve of Howth, and it ran a week late. So the volunteers go down the week it's coming, and the local papers report extensively about all the unusual activity of vehicles going into Kilcool, volunteer activity, and nobody seems to pick up on it a week later when the actual operation takes place a week later. Nobody in Dublin Castle seems to have picked up what was being reported in the papers that weekend. The weapons were spirited away to Dublin, and they basically wound up in Rathfarnham, and then they would have been scattered out to the local Irish volunteers, because I think the practice was that the Irish volunteers, you could buy a rifle, and members used to subscribe weekly for the rifle. So a lot of them probably wound up in 1916. Those that were hidden away, some of them surfaced probably during the War of Independence, but given that there was an average of about 30 rounds of ammunition for each rifle, it wasn't a lot really for gauge. So once you fired your 30 shots, your rifle was useless because it was an obsolete type of round that was fired in that rifle. So it wasn't compatible with the British Army ammunition. So once you fired your 30 shots, the rifle was useless.
Brian, did you want to come in there?
Just very quickly on the Kilcool gun running, one of the charabangs bringing the guns back to Rathfarnham and Dublin, the axle broke on the Upper Darker Road and the guns had to be dispersed locally in the houses, and that then caused a raid by the police and the army on the houses in the Bray area.
Okay. Now, before I move on, I just want to make a point in terms of, we're talking here about the Irish Volunteers and also the Loyal Volunteers. And they're getting headlines, right? But, Rosemary, the main headlines, I'm talking in the British press, British and Irish press, pre-1914, the people who were throwing the bombs, who were doing the arson attacks, are actually suffragettes, not Irish nationalists, right? So is there any of that sort of activity in this neighbourhood?
Well, from around 1909 on, you have sort of open-air meetings by the various suffrage groups. Probably even before that, there have been kind of drawing room meetings and so on around Greystones and Bray. And then in 1910, you have what's really the first action of the militant IWFL, who, when Hanashe Skeffington and Hilda Webb actually accost the chief secretary on the pier at Greystones. And that's kind of known as the beginning of the militant campaign in a very minor way. But then right through the next 3 years, you have open-air meetings, mostly in sort of Bray, Greystones, then down in Wicklow and Arklow. And they have quite notable speakers like Charlotte Despard, Margaret Cousins came a couple of times, Helen Chenevics. I think it was mainly constitutional activism, really, apart from that moment on the pier. The militant movement didn't have any actions here, but there certainly were a lot of open air meetings, and that would have brought the word to a wider public. And then they again the railway, the importance of the railway was mentioned earlier. I think the important thing really for getting the word out was access through the railway and also sort of local sympathisers. So you actually have meetings down in places like Dunlavin and Glass as well.
Now, from the names you've mentioned, what I've been saying, they're mainly at the nationalist Republican end of the spectrum, or did the suffragette movement transcend the Catholic
No, it did very much transcend the divide, particularly in the early years. And as I say, out here in Greystones, it would have been mainly the constitutional middle class sort of unionist tinged area of the suffrage movement. And in fact, interestingly, one of the women who signed the Ulster Declaration, Lady Cowan, I came across her as the leader of one of the smaller suffrage groups. So there's a crossover there as well.
James, you want to come in there very quickly?
Yeah, just very quickly. There was one of the militant things they used to do in Bray was to throw a bottle of ink into the mailbox at the post office, and the ink used to scatter over all the envelopes, and the post office would have to try and salvage them. And it got to this stage that I had to have a postman. They actually had to close the outside of the post box and have a policeman inside the post office watching the people posting their mail because the post office, when the ink got on the envelopes, then they had to try and salvage and return them, either forward them if they could, if possible, or else they had to open them and return them back to the recipient and say, sorry, this has been destroyed in the post. But this was a great lark where a bottle of ink would be just thrown into the letterbox.
I'm tempted to quote Albert Reynolds here. That's women for you. But anyway, that's suffragettes for you.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to move on to the First World War. Brian, if I could bring you in this one, I'm assuming there would have been fairly high British Army recruitment, just as it was everywhere in Wicklow.
In the area of Bray, the catchment area, and there was a recruitment office in Bray that looked after the area from Bray down to Rathnew, including the towns of Newtown Mount Kennedy. And both Rathnew and Newtown Mount Kennedy hold the honour of having the highest number of males to enlist anywhere in the British Isles at 26.9% of the population.
That's pretty big.
Interesting. On the Roll of Honour then for the Bray area that would cover, again, Bray, Enniskerry and South County Dublin, there was 937 names. If we look then at Harry Dowman was the recruitment officer, and again, an awful lot of the landowners gave a £5 bounty to any of their estate workers that enlisted and came back with a good record. And that was a most important sub-point to the thing, that they had a good record. Lord Meath then organised a training camp on Bray Head because he thought that the men going to the front should be well trained. And most of the people in the regiments were the Leinster regiments and the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. We also had two hospitals in Bray for the wounded soldiers in the war. And again, after the war, we had housing for the soldiers, both in Killincarrig and Bray and in Greystones and other locations around the county. Probably the most famous one is the at Elba Ridge in the First World War. You have Father Gleeson, who was a curate in Bray, given general absolution. And then we also had Belgian refugees in the town.
Okay. John, did you want to come in on this?
Yeah, just to back up something Brian was saying, this curious thing in County Wicklow, which you don't see in many places in the south of Ireland, certainly, where you have landowners really encouraging their labourers to join up and offering them kind of financial reward for doing it, which is very interesting. A real kind of pre-land war kind of pattern. Another thing that will impact on our discussion later is that particular part of East County Wicklow, the coastal part, was referred to by Republicans as a very Seanean area in later years. That probably had a lot to do with the predominance of war service there, I suspect.
Okay, Rosemary, you want to come in there?
Again, of course, as you'd expect, Greystones had a high recruitment rate. There are 22 names on the tablet, the remembrance tablet in St. Patrick's Church, but that's only those who were actually members of the parish. So, in fact, there are something like 66 names altogether that I can trace, and there are probably more with that particular name who died in the First World War. And, in fact, one of those sort of came to light again quite recently because a man called Robert Johnson, who was a chauffeur in Greystones, he signed up in the very last days of the war to join the RAF and promptly died of the flu. So he died the day after Armistice Day, and a couple of days later arrived home, was brought home for burial in Delgany Churchyard, and they've only recently put up the Commonwealth War grave there to him.
Now, James, I want to move this on. I think it's fairly well accepted now that recruitment, British Army recruitment, was in decline well before 1916, the 1916 Rising. But having said that, what sort of effect did the Rising and its aftermath have in North County Wicklow?
Move people into the volunteer movement, because the mistake which the authorities made in Dublin Castle was they clamped down on everybody. And they made life difficult with restrictions and things like that. They took the attitude that everybody was supporting Sinn Féin.
How many were arrested in this area, by the way?
I haven't seen a number for those who were arrested, because they sort of tightly controlled the press. So you get a pattern after 1917 when they're clapping down on Sinn Féin. You're getting raids on houses, looking for documents and things like that. And they're using DORA, the Defence of the Realm Act, to detain people, to try them, and people are getting 3 months sentence because they're seditious literature and things like that. And it's not to move later into the War of Independence that they get much more severe powers under the Restoration of Order of Ireland Act, which already gives them a carte blanche. Then you can be interned without having been tried and already been turned on suspicion. So there's quite a lot of activity going on. Of course, post the Rising courses, again, common men are out on the ground. They're convincing the people that these are heroes. They're not to be despised, the way Dublin Castle is churning out the whole thing. They were treacherous and things like that. So, it moves people into the movement because the authorities used a heavy hand, unfortunately.
So you're suggesting then it's the government reaction that radicalizes people, if they weren't radical.
It is, yeah. You see, Bray, like, for instance, my grandfather was a Redmanite, but after 1960, he moves over to support the national cause, the Sinn Féin cause. And there were probably lots of people like that shifted over because they were tired of being bossed around and bullied around. I mean, he wants to go into his business after 1916. You can't go in. He goes looking for horses that were taken by the military, and he's told, well, we don't have a record of them, so tough luck. And they sort of didn't believe that the authorities would actually destroy their businesses and things like that. And so this sort of heavy-handedness, dead-handed bureaucracy is moving. Moderates are moving over to the militant side because they realise, you know, it's not going to happen. And of course, they realise too, the Redmond supporters, Home Rule is not going to happen because the conferences fail. And all of a sudden, it's not going to be the thing that they thought they were going to get.
Okay, let's move things on then, because this all comes to fruition then in the 1918 general election. John, if I go to you, because you have, first of all, the East Wicklow constituency is contested, not by two, but it's a three-way contest. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that going back a bit further, I mean, you know, in the 1880s, you had, in the time of the first Home Rule Bill, you had quite fierce competition between the Home Rulers and the Unionists. Now, that faded away in the 1890s, and it wasn't contested. The constituency wasn't contested for about 20 years. But in 1918, you're right, Tommy, there was three candidates. There was Sean Etchingham of Sinn Féin. He was a Wexford man who had been part of the rising in Enniscorthy in 1916, where they did actually take over the town for a week and were prepared to hold it, only they got orders to surrender from Dublin. But he was interned after 1916, also interned in the so-called German plot, the roundup of nationalist activists in 1918. And so with his rising service and having been interned, he's a militant Republican figure. You have Alexander Keane, who is the Unionist candidate. And the Unionists poll quite a few votes. Like they poll, in the end, Etchingham polls nearly 6,000, 5,900. But Alexander Keane, the Unionist, polls 2,500 votes. And there's a third candidate, as you rightly say, and that's Dennis Cogan, who's the representative of the previously dominant Irish Parliamentary Party, the Home Rule Party. And he gets about 2,500 votes as well. So between them, they have nearly as many votes as Etchingham in the end. But the kind of discourse around the election is very interesting as well. So Etchingham's message is, you know, not surprising. It's for, you know, the freedom of Ireland and so on like this. Keane, the Unionist, and this is very common also with the Dublin Unionists, quite a few of whom run, and one of whom gets elected in 1918, Maurice Dockrell. But he says his policy is the Union and nothing but the Union. And reading between the lines a little bit, what this means is the Union and no partition, actually. So he wants no Home Rule and no partition. And it's kind of a losing hand by that point, you know, which is possibly why Southern Unionism fades away so quickly. But Dennis Cogan, the Home Rulers line, is also very interesting. He doesn't go in for anti-republican rhetoric, anti-separatist rhetoric to get at Etchingham. What he says is Sinn Féin represents atheistical socialism.
Well, that's interesting. So they're using all kind of Red Scare tactics.
Correct, yeah. And you see this quite a lot in 1918 and also in the by-elections. You know, that the IPP tried to attack Sinn Féin by saying that they're radicals, they're socialists, they're atheists, which is not the case, of course, except in a minority of cases.
Oh, by the way, the next issue of History Ireland, the January-February issue, we will have an article on Sir Maurice Dockrell, who is the only Unionist elected outside Ulster and Trinity College. Very, very interesting character. Rosemary, mentioned as we made this already, and I don't want to depress listeners by reminding them that the current pandemic wasn't the first pandemic that this country suffered. Because, of course, this is the period of the so-called Spanish flu. Now, would I be right in assuming that as a tourist area, with lots of people coming into it, you know, during the summer, that this area would be more badly affected by the flu than others? Or am I right or wrong on that?
Yes, it was certainly one of the areas which was worst affected. Whether that was because of tourism, I'm not sure, but certainly it was because of the proximity to Dublin and the proximity to the ports. And you see it coming in through Bray, hitting, for instance, railway employees, and then spreading down the coast, sort of really quite fast down the coast, and then inland after that. Yes, right through for the three phases of the flu, the one in the summer, the one in the autumn, and then the one in the following spring, Wicklow was always one of the worst affected areas. But particular sectors of the community, as I say, railway workers, postal workers were very badly hit. Medical personnel, of course, police. And then obviously, if you were living in close proximity, one of the first places, for instance, you get a reference to is Glencree Industrial School. So obviously institutions would also be badly affected, and people living in crowded conditions, the poor living in small houses. Although it did spread across the classes. You do get references to, for instance, the Honourable Hugh Howard, who was a unionist politician. He was one of the victims. So it was sort of cross community, but obviously if you were poor, you were in a worse condition to deal with it.
James, you want to come in there?
Just basically they didn't understand the concept of social distancing or anything like that. So you still had mass public gatherings, and what arrangements were carried out by in public varied. So in one particular place down the country, they might close the schools. In Dublin, they might leave the theatres open and things like that. Though in Dublin, they did have to close the schools because of shortage of teachers. And then there were wrangles over trying to get medical practitioners, because they were going down like nine pins as well. So they were badly affected. And then trying to get replacements, because basically, from 1915 onwards, if you were a doctor, you were expected to do military service, and only those doctors that were left in Ireland were all temporary. So there was a great gap in the medical profession as regards doctors in the front line. They had no vaccines and things like that. So they really didn't know what they were dealing with. I mean, it wasn't until 1932 they discovered that it was the H1N1 virus. So it just gives you an idea of the state of medical facilities at that time.
Can I just make a general observation here? Because, I mean, we've had dedicated head schools on the flu, and it's come up again and again in discussion.
Yeah.
But I get the impression it's not really front and center of people's concerns. Like, one almost gets the impression that people are used to the idea of dying from various diseases, that it's just an accepted part of life.
We've had pandemics in Ireland about every 100 years. If you go back to 1300, but every 100 years, 50 years, there was some outbreak, or the Black Death, cholera, things like that. Even up in the 1870s, you were getting it. And even late in the 50s, we forget we had outbreaks of the flu. Hong Kong, smallpox and things. We had outbreaks of the flu. In the 50s and 60s, there were one or two outbreaks of flu. But we were lucky in Ireland, in the sense being in Ireland, we escaped most of it. But if you go to Europe, every 50 years, they had a pandemic of some sort, or the flu, cholera, malaria, diseases, you know, that had been imported. Where Ireland, we were lucky, but still, you know, the pandemic of 19 was probably our last big one, other than the current situation. But in between, we've had outbreaks. Again, we had polio in the 50s, but again, they got a vaccine for that. And I remember getting the shots, having to get the three shots for that in the health centre. Nowadays, the kids just get a sugar cube.
Yeah. No, I got the shot. Jesus, it was feck and sore, so
it was.
I remember I was about three or four at the time. Brian, and then I go to John. You want to come in, Brian?
Yeah, well, Dr. Rafferty visited 74 houses in Little Bray in October of 1918, and he had 300 cases in 74 houses. And then the following week, he was visited again, and he had 600 cases. So you can see the doubling of the number of cases. He was working 18-hour days, and he applied to the Rathdown Board of Guardians for assistance. And only a month later did he get assistance with the aid of a Dr. Dempsey. And then in February of 1919, the Bray Urban Council made it a notifiable disease.
John, you want to come in on the flu?
Yeah, just two quick points on the flu, Tommy. One of them is that the second wave, just like now, I suppose, but much, much more deadly, of the second wave of the 1918 flu in Ireland was November, December 1918. And it coincided with two things, with the armistice in World War One and with the election campaign, you know, the first general election. And so, like, there was big gatherings of people, and I am pretty sure this facilitated the spread. And what you see in different parts of the country is people kind of projecting onto it their political prejudices. Like in Tipperary, there are statements that the loyalists, or the separation women, the people who were in the war, they all got it because they were celebrating Armistice Day. Elsewhere, some people like Kevin O'Sheill and Tyrone said the Sinn Féin supporters all got it because they were out campaigning and they all went to mass, you know, stuff like this.
So the collective shaming is nothing new.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. The other thing though, just quick point on the pandemic of 1918 before we move on, is you know, you do wonder, like James said, why they didn't take more stringent measures back then. But then you look at the death rates. So the death rates, leaving aside the pandemic of 1918, were well over three times, I think, what they were now. Like, there was twice as many absolute deaths in Ireland in 1911, according to the census, that than there would be today when the population was far smaller. This is the 32 county population. So, you know, death, early death from disease was much, much more common in that era.
Okay, guys, I want to move things on now to the local elections of 1920. Now, there were elections in January and there were elections in June. So, Brian, maybe I'll bring you in on this. When did the elections take place in Wicklow, or when, did they take place at both times?
You had elections in June where the 20 seats were elected to the Wicklow County Council. And again, Bray had five people elected to the Wicklow County Council, four of them being of a Sinn Féin background. You also had the local Bray municipal district elections as well. And of the 12 seats, 11 went to Sinn Féin, one went to Lord Powerscourt.
That's like pretty much a Sinn Féin victory right across the board.
Yeah.
I mean, John, just in terms of the national picture, that's quite surprising because in other parts of the country, it was a little bit more nuanced. So you got the odd Labour person, even the odd kind of unionist of some sort or another. I mean, that's a big victory for Sinn Féin in such a mixed, you know, inverted commas county.
Yeah, it's curious because the unions seem to have melted away as a political force. I mean, just up the coast in Dublin, they didn't. You know, you have unionists and former unionists dominating a lot of the South Dublin urban and rural district councils. You have Labour very important in Dunleary or Kingstown, as it then was, and the district council there. And they actually cooperated with the unionists in 1920. Not out of conviction, because generally Labour were pro independence, but because if you identified with the Republic, like, for example, Bray Urban District Council declared for the Republic in June 1920 and their funding was cut off. And the Labour people were worried that if they went along with this in Dunleary or in Kingstown, that their funding would be cut off and all their members who were, you know, road workers and stuff like that wouldn't be paid anymore. But yeah, the Sinn Féin victory in Wicklow was, yeah, it's very notable. One of my colleagues here might be able to explain it better than me.
Yeah, I don't know who can come in on this, like, but does that not seem to suggest that a lot of Wicklow Protestants were voting Sinn Féin? Brian, any comment on that?
Yes, but if you look at the Robert Barton, who was a relation of the Childers, he was a Wicklow Protestant, and again, Wicklow Protestants really got behind Sinn Féin and some of the rural, the farming people, because the Farmers Association, out of the 20 seats to Wicklow County Council, only voted on two candidates for the whole of the county.
Okay, well, Rosemary, can you want to comment on that? I mean, on the face of it, it would seem they must be voting for somebody, or maybe they're just staying at home, not voting at all.
Possibly there was certainly a lot of the people from Greystones would have been business people, often with businesses in Dublin as well. They may have taken that sort of pragmatic view of what was coming. But I'd say Brian's probably right. The fact that Barton was a candidate may have sugared the pill to some extent. That combined with, I think, pragmatism, perhaps.
Okay, guys, now I want to move on to the actual shooting war here, such as it existed. John Dorney, bring you in here. I mean, is the North Wicklow region, for all practical purposes, simply an extension of Dublin? And I say that with some trepidation in the present company, right? No, because what was the setup there? Like, how did Wicklow, the IRA in Wicklow, fit into the national structures?
Well, just in terms of IRA organisation and with all, you know, respect to Wicklow people and their sensibilities. No, Bray, for example, and a lot of North County Wicklow was part of 6th Battalion, which of the Dublin Brigade. So strictly in organisational terms, a good bit of North Wicklow was Dublin from an IRA point of view. Then, you know, on the other side of the mountains and over in West Wicklow, you know, the area around Blessington was later incorporated also into first of all, the Kildare and then the 2nd Dublin Brigade. And down in the very south of Wicklow, you know, part of it is part of the Carlow Brigade. So there's really only a small part that the Wicklow Brigade itself actually covers. Christopher Byrne, who's the Quartermaster General, makes this point that, you know, a lot of the more active areas weren't even in the Wicklow Brigade, strictly speaking. It was kind of, you know, Roundwood and that kind of area of central Wicklow and Wicklow Town. Another factor is that a lot of very active people in a military sense, so like Vinnie Byrne and Tom Cullen,
who ended up in IRA intelligence under Collins, gravitated to Dublin as well. So Dublin drains off a lot of kind of active separatists from Wicklow. But Wicklow's not a terribly active county in terms of military activity, though, certainly not.
But just Vinnie Byrne, by the way, he's one of Collins' squad, which was right. featured a lot in recent discussions on Bloody Sunday. Maybe, James, if I'm bringing you in here, like, so what kind of stuff did go on in Wicklow?
The basic operations were basically sniping attacks, nuisance attacks. There were a few operations, minor operations. I think there was a major operation in Rathdrome, but it turned out the pistols they had weren't very, very good. And that was one of the problems, that the quality of firearms they had in some cases were being siphoned off by Dublin. Otherwise, it was nuisance attacks, trenching. They had a case where they burned two ambulances in the goods yards in Bray Railway Station. They used to shoot up the police barracks in Cabinteely. It was a regular occurrence, as was Bray Barracks and in Askerry. And basically what happens, a rifleman will go out, fire a few shots for the night and keep the soldiers on their toes all night on the alert. They were basic nuisance value attacks is basically what. There was no major big operation that you could say that captured the headlines. Nuisance attacks, just hit and run, were the operations. The major only fatality we had was a volunteer who was killed in Shankill during a raiding party. Shot went off by the raiding party, and volunteer William Owens was killed in December 1920. He's the only direct fatality that we have in the area that I'm aware of, but I'm open to correction on this. And again, his inquiry was held behind closed doors under the Restoration of Ard Act, and the registrar in Rathdown wrote in that he wrote down the official verdict, and he added the note, inquest, verdict from Court of Inquiry in lieu of inquests.
John, can I just bring you in here for comment? Because in terms of the low level of activity in Wicklow, it's not that unusual compared to other counties. You know what I mean? Like, the point is, if you take Cork, Tip, you know, some of these counties out of it, there's not that much happening in over large parts of Ireland. Not much happening militarily now, I stress. I'm talking about the narrow definition of armed activity.
Yeah, you'll be right there. The problem again, you know, you have hardware. How many weapons have you got? You can have as many rifles as you like, but if you've only two or three rounds, you can't do a lot. And that's one of the big problems the volunteers have. The British Army has a standard 0.303. That round fits the rifle, it fits the Lewis machine gun, it fits the heavy machine gun fine. For pistol ammunition, it's the 0.455 round. So that's grand. The volunteers have a motley collection of weapons. They have shotguns. Fine, except you've got to keep the paper cartridges dry. If they get damp, they'll jam, so you have problems. You've got to clean your ammunition. That's what happened to poor Kevin Barry. He was handed a pistol straight away. He didn't clean the ammo. It jammed and he got caught. That's not the first time that's happened with firearms. Scarcity of ammunition, variety of weapons. Smith & Wesson's, for instance, if you got 0.38 ammunition, it had to be, if you had Smith & Wesson's, it had to be 0.38 Smith & Wesson, because Smith & Wesson engineered their weapons that would only fire their ammo and things like that. So you have major problems. If you got if you stole 45 caliber automatic weapons, you had to see where they, the RAF version or the Colt version, because the RAF version fired a slightly different round. So you have major problems for the quartermasters, and again, scarcity of ammunition. And of course, the other thing is that the guys in Dublin are siphoning off all the quality arms, because that's where the big struggle is. So in Wicklow, it's hit and run. And because it's an urban environment, it's very difficult to go around with rifles under your coats. You can if you're a flying country, a column going across the country, say up in the Wicklow Mountains or in Kildare. Otherwise, it's just handguns and improvised devices as best you can.
John, you want to come in there?
Just a quick point there. I mean, you're right in the sense that most of Ireland didn't experience kind of a war as we imagine that term to be. But if you look at it in another way, like there's 11 people killed in Wicklow, you know, in 1920 and 21. And if you say in County Wicklow in a normal year, there was 11 political murders, we'd be outraged. So it's better in a way to look at it like that. And to, you know, the county was considered disturbed to the extent that they brought in a regiment of the British Army or a battalion of the Royal Cheshire Regiment. They were camped out in Lord Pyrscourt's estate near Enniskerry. So, you know, it's not a normal environment either. You know, people say, well, there wasn't a war. That's true in County Wicklow. But, you know, it was a very disturbed time as well.
Now, just something that strikes me as unusual. I mean, the Wicklow Mountains, from the IRA's point of view, are a massive resource. was it underused, John? Because you know, I know Ernie O'Malley has something to say about this.
Yeah, Ernie O'Malley lived in Dublin most of his life, but he doesn't seem to have been aware of the Wicklow Mountains really until the Civil War, when he passed through it kind of trying to escape from Dublin. And he was struck by what an amazing guerrilla resource it was. There's only one road going through the centre of the Wicklow Mountains, military road. It's very remote. You could keep dugouts, you could keep arms dumps, you could hide loads of guerrillas there. It would be easy to attack anyone who was bringing a military force in. And yet it was hardly used at all, except really as arms dumps. It was used a little bit more in the Civil War, but not really at all in that respect in the War of Independence.
Well, I mean, it was used during the recent troubles. I can remember years and years ago, you know, wandering in the Glenavimal region, and you know, you mightn't be sure which particular army you'd come across in your wanderings, you know. But let's not go there.
Just more quick comment though on that, in connection with that, Tommy, is one thing it was used for was in the truce period. There was a lot of training camps set up there.
Okay.
By the IRA.
Now, Brian, what about compensation claims amongst people, you know, at the receiving end of IRA activity?
Well, I think if you look at the county as a whole, you had 271 compensation claims for the period of 1919 to 1923. Of those compensation claims, 176 of them were for the Bray, Greystones, Enniskerry, Newtown, Mount Kennedy area. It basically breaks down into sort of three areas. One is the loss of property, whether it's fuelstuffs or petrol, or the loss of cars. Mrs. Hudson of Hollybrook lost two cars in a matter of 1 month. A bit unfortunate. Then you had the claim for compensation for the destruction of post offices, coast guard stations, courthouses, orange halls, buildings of that nature. And then the other one then is the in relation to crops and hay barns being destroyed, whether these were done as claim and compo or just as people being warned off, don't tell the military, we're around the place, and compensation claims go in. It's hard to define what exactly, with the latter one, is the reason for the compensation claim.
James, can I bring you in here? Because one of your articles on the Wicklow Heritage site, a very intriguing article, is about transport restrictions. Just explain to us what that's about, James.
Well, basically, from 1918 onwards, the authorities brought in, under DORA, the Defence of the Realm Act, which was the pre-Restoration of Ireland Act, they brought in a requirement that they got the idea that motorcycles were being used to convey stuff around the place. So they made it a requirement that you had to have a permit to have a motorcycle, and you had to get it from the competent chief of police or military authority in the district. You had to carry this with you all the time when you were out on the road to say that you were the licensed permit holder of the vehicle. And then in 1918, they extended this to motor cars. So you had to carry this permit with you all the time. Now, as more and more vehicles were used to carry vehicles, carry arms and people around the country, under the Restoration Act, they really brought it in, and they brought in additional regulations laying down that you had to have a permit stating where the car was held, who owned it, and they laid down what time you could use it. Basically, you could only use your car between 6 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock at night because there was a curfew, and if you were pulled up by a patrol then, unless you were a clergyman or a veteran or a doctor, you could be arrested and detained. And they later extended this then, later in 1921, to bicycles. So there was, motors didn't have the carte blanche. They had to produce that. They were also limited under the 1920 legislation. You could only go 20 miles. So if you wanted to go more than that, you had to apply for permission. So if you were planning to go from, say, Bray to Wicklow, which is about 30 miles, you'd have to go to the competent authority and say, I need a permit to go because I'm going further than the distance.
Sounds a bit like Tony Hoolan today.
We talk about the 5 kilometre rule, but at that stage there was a 20 mile rule, and the authorities were very vigilant. I mean, admittedly there weren't the massive array of cars and vehicles we had now, but they were quite aware that vehicles were being used to smuggle arms and people around the place, and they wanted to restrict their use at night time, to accept those who were authorised to be on the road at night, say doctors, vets, and clergymen, and things like that.
Now, John Dorney, I want to bring you in here on the other side of the fence, like Crown Forces in Wicklow, because I know, for example, Kilbride, just outside Blessington, where my father's from, incidentally, there was a military camp there. So there was always a substantial military establishment in Wicklow, even during peacetime. What was the situation during this period?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, going back to, again, this idea of, in some ways, you could compare the situation in the War of Independence and a lot of Ireland to more like the land war, more agitation than military. But there was a boycott of the RSC that was enforced from 1919 onwards. And this is noted by the British military report for Dublin. Like, again, the British military area, Wicklow, was part of Dublin. The Kilbride base was withdrawn in mid-1920, because they feared it would be attacked. It was vulnerable to attack, and they withdrew. It was a musketry school. They brought in, as I said before, the Royal Cheshire Regiment, who camped in Enniskerry in the grounds of Lord Perriscourt's estate. And that may have reflected Viscount Perriscourt's sympathies, I'm not sure. He was a former military man himself, but he may have had no choice. It may have been commandeered. And their role was basically to back up the RIC in terms of carrying out raids, as James talked about, in terms of carrying out arrests. But as far as I know, no soldiers were even injured in Wicklow during the War of Independence. There was a number of RIC killed, I think 3 or 4, someone can correct me on that, including a number killed in coordinated attack in Rathdrum in 1921. But there was quite a lot of raids and arrests. There was a big roundup in and around Roundwood and Wicklow in 1921, on November 1920, of civilian activists, actually, after Bloody Sunday. But in terms of large actions, no, there wasn't much.
James, you want to come in there?
Okay. When the squad went to assassinate Detective Smith in Dublin, who was the first DMPG man to be shot, they found the .38 revolvers they had weren't up to scratch. And Collins had a policy of always siphoning off the best weapons for his men. He discovered the guys down in Rathdrum had some good firearms. So he did a swap, like, you give me your 4 pistols, I give you 10. And when the local volunteers used these weapons against the Rathdrum things, they weren't up to scratch. And I think one of the volunteers was killed as a result because they weren't up to scratch. Because there were probably a lot of the firearms they had, we described now what they call America Saturday Night Specials. They were only good if you were 3 or 4 feet away. They were really just useless. They were just for close personal protection, not suitable for a proper operation. Whereas the military grade Webley revolver was a fine revolver to use. But the problem was
bigger slug, basically.
A bigger slug, but it also had a ferocious kick. So the guys really liked the .38. But the problem was they needed the .45 for the thump. And that's why the squad used the .45 for the thump. The rule was you shoot him in the leg, knocks him to the ground, and the other fellow goes over and puts a bullet in his head. So 2 bullets and you're dead. And that was Collins' rule. And the famous joke about Vinnie Byrne, we're talking, Vinnie goes in, he goes into Collins and he says, "I riddled him." And Collins says, "Riddled him?" He says, "Where do you think bullets grow on trees?" And that was in the film Michael Collins. It's an actual quote. It was actually said by Collins. He gave out to Vinnie Byrne because ammunition was so scarce. And that's one of the problems. Scarcity of ammunition is a problem they face all the time. I mean, even Rory Manley writes, I think, in one of his books, where boys were able to refill rifle cartridges, but they couldn't neck bullets. So they used to cast bullets in lead and then put them point in, conscious that they were actually using flat nose bullets. And you find lots of references in the thing about flat nose bullets and dum-dum bullets and things like that being used. But that was one of the problems they had. They hadn't got necking machines to neck the bullet right way round into the cartridge. So just tap it in because lead was point inwards into the cartridge. And this was a major problem they had all the way. Same with the shotgun cartridge. Said you had to keep them dry. They got damp. You could put in the shotgun, but you wouldn't get a loot.
Right. Now, Rosemary, maybe go back to you on this. Maybe John could come in this as well. Mm. Again, one of the remarkable things, given the high, Protestant population, right, is the lack of sectarian violence, it would seem to me. Because, I mean, it did crop up in other parts of the country, Cork, supposedly, even Tipperary, but not in Wicklow. Any comment on that?
Well, I suppose in Greystones, it was so strongly Protestant in a way that sectarianism almost didn't arise in a sense. There are references to the difficulties of recruiting volunteers or IRA in Greystones because so many of the young men who were there were actually working for Protestant companies or Protestant farmers, so they weren't on for joining. So, yes, certainly, I think in terms of sectarian confrontations, Greystones would have been more or less an area on its own. I'm not sure that it adds a great deal to the wider Wicklow picture.
Right. Brian, you want to come in on that?
Just very quickly, one of the reasons probably why the not a lot of volunteers came from the Bray area was the president of Sinn Féin, the Reverend Michael O'Flanagan, was living in Bray, and he was the person who's at the prayers at the opening of the first stall in 1918.
Now, John, do you want to come in on this sectarian issue?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, like, to back up what Rosemary said, you know, you have to bear in mind that not a great deal had happened in terms of conflict at all in County Wicklow, in some parts especially of the county. Another thing, though, is in Dublin, again, the sectarian thing doesn't happen, despite the fact that there was actually an armed loyalist group in Dublin in 1914. But it's the dog that never bit. So in terms of what we might expect, it would probably, if there was sectarian, you know, violence in Wicklow, it would probably look something like Cork, where it's not so much Protestants and paramilitary groups like in the Special Constabulary in Ulster, more like aiding Crown forces as informers, riding around with them, pointing people out, which did happen in Cork. And that seems to have resulted in this thing of the IRA killing a lot of Protestants as informers. And it's very disputed why they did this in places like West Cork, whether it was sectarian or not. But that doesn't happen in County Wicklow. Another thing, though, that's interesting to bear in mind is in February 1921, down in Dunlavin, so outside of the part of Wicklow we're talking about, but in Dunlavin, a loyalist called Robert Dixon was shot dead by William Mitchell, who was a black and tan. And him and another one were actually raiding his house. Now, you know, the trope that the black and tans were criminals before they came to Ireland is not true. Some of them were criminals in Ireland, so they were doing housebreaking across the area, disguised out of
Europe.
And they shot dead this guy. He was a staunch loyalist, Robert Dixon, who had been helping the police. And this probably discouraged a lot of loyalists, I suspect, from actively aiding Crown forces. Mitchell was later hanged in Mountjoy for the shooting. And the other guy who was in on the housebreaking shot himself out of remorse, apparently.
Right. Yeah, John, you mentioned several of the 11 killed in Wicklow were suicides, weren't they? Or did I get that right?
Yeah. And this is, I was trawling, when I was preparing for this, I was trawling through the recent Dead of the Irish Revolution, and they include Crown Forces suicides. And there was, apart from Hardy, there was another RC suicide somewhere in County Wicklow during the period as well. But I mean, you know, you're under great stress, you're living in barracks, a lot of them have been through the war as well. It's probably not that surprising that some of their mental states wasn't that great at the time.
Now, Brian, before we move on to wrap up on the War of Independence, there is a little story here, a naval story with a Wicklow connection. The Hazel West. Explain to us who was made.
Sorry, bring up there,
Hazel West, you know, what's the naval connection?
Well, Hazel West married a Herbert Corling Leverton in 1908, and their marriage was on the rocks. So they were invited by the Johnston family to go to Baleek in County Fermanagh in 1922. And Hazel had also a yacht on Loch Earn called the Lady of the Lake. And the yacht was commandeered to rescue some Ulster special constables that were held captured or trapped in a place near Baleek, a place called Matlamore.
Now, just explain the geography of this, because again, although my father's from Wicklow, I was born in Ballyshannon, just so Baleek shows up the road. And this is one of the things that the ludicrousness of partition in a way, because it left the Pettigo, the so-called Pettigo Triangle, totally cut off from the rest of Northern Ireland. And all these poor specials were stranded there, and they had to be rescued.
Yes. So the boat had to, this Lady of the Lake boat was commandeered by the army and was renamed HMS Pandora. But Mrs. Hazel West or Mrs. Laverton was still on board with a pistol on our hip and a telescope in the other hand, heading up Loch Earn to rescue these special Ulster constabularies. And she got the nickname as the Ulster Admiral.
There we go. And she's from Wicklow.
From Wicklow Crony. And she's part of the West family who had a jeweller shop in Grafton Street in Dublin.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that was there not so long ago. John, just want to go to you to wrap up then on the state of play, say at the time of the truce. Like, so what sort of shape was the IRA in? Because I'm assuming then that this region of North Wicklow is tied into the Dublin situation. And I know we had the big attack on, say, the Customs House in May 1921, which is variously a great IRA victory or a terrible defeat, depending on who you talk to. So what sort of shape were they in at the time of the truce?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Customs House thing, my take on it would be it was a big reverse for the IRA. They did lose a lot of people in Dublin. but that there was plenty more to take their place. I mean, the IRA is still going in Dublin City, be under no illusion. In the area we're talking about, the important formation is the 6th Battalion, which is South County Dublin and North Wicklow. And they're still very much on the go. In fact, they've recruited at this point a number of former British soldiers from the First World War, including one, Rodney Murphy, who were sharpshooters, you know, and they'd added that to their arsenal. They're very much still on the go in South Dublin and North Wicklow at the time.
So now, just before we wrap up, guys, I just want to go to Brian, right? Because Brian, but incidentally, the reason we're stopping at the truce here, lads, is that there are plans for more head schools on the Civil War in relation to Wicklow. And of course, there's a much bigger story there to be told. So we haven't ignored it, right? But before we wrap up here, Brian, can you kind of go to you, because there is an interesting epilogue to this, the making of the film Irish Destiny in 1926. There is a Wicklow connection there.
Well, the film is based around an IRA man who was raised in a village called Clonmore that happens to be an Askeri. And the film then is shot in and around the village. He also goes to Dublin to warn some of his colleagues. He's arrested, interned in Kildare, escapes from Kildare, comes back and rescues his girlfriend, who happens to be living in the house that was owned by Henry Grattan. And the film, although it was filmed in Ireland called The Irish Destiny, it was released in England as An Irish Mother to get round the Censorship Act.
Of course, I should have flagged various, what's the ones I'm looking for? You've given away the plot there, Brian, to lots of our listeners. No, you haven't substantially, right? It's a very interesting film, actually. And the first made about the War of Independence. I mean,
true, yes. And it's interesting that this then sort of creates a film industry in County Wicklow with the establishment of Ardmore in 1958. And one of Michael Collins's trusted lieutenants, Emmett Dalton, becomes the first CEO of the new Ardmore Studios. And across the road, you had Silver Pine Studios that was run by Bill Stapleton. But Bill Stapleton was the son of William Stapleton, another trusted commandant of Michael Collins.
And they're not the only ones. There's several people. The name just escaped me at the moment who ended up going into the movie business in America. James, you want to come in there?
Just a quick point that frequently footage from Irish Destiny is often passed off as footage for the War of as actuality footage. And of course, one of the last films that we had about the War of Independence under Michael Collins was Shake Hands with the Devil, which was made in Ardmore Studios under the control of Emmett Dalton, who of course was with Collins. And it was one of the first appearances of Slieve na Bán, the armoured car. And then it went back to the workshops until it was totally restored in recent years. So just two little links there.
By the way, on the question of staged, you know, film and photographs, yeah. Masquerading is a real thing.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. As editor of this magazine, I've been educated over the years as to what is and is not a genuine shot of a black and tan or an auxiliary.
Yeah.
Listen, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up there. That was a great discussion. And we've apart from John Dorney here, these are all local historians here, doing a very good job of it, I have to say. So we're going to repeat this exercise for the next head school, which will be posted in the new year. And we're going to look at the South Wicklow area, which, as everyone from Wicklow knows, is a totally different planet altogether. Listen, I'd just like to thank all our panel here today, Rosemary Water, James Scannell, Brian White, and John Dorney. And I'd just like to thank you, the listeners, and I hope you tune in to the next History on the Head School. Thank you.